No, he said. And he didn't say another word. Chapter 75. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 12:44 p.m. Skip looked jumpy from what had happened in the plant. He'd been pelted pretty good by the falling debris from Dietrich's rescue and had bruises and butterfly stitches on his face. While he waited for me to speak, his fingers kept lacing and unlacing on the tabletop. "That was some shit, wasn't it?" he asked, giving me a nervous laugh. "It was memorable," I agreed, and then I gave him another dose of the long, silent treatment. His reaction was the exact opposite of Ollie's. Skip was younger and more high-strung. His hands and eyes never stopped moving. He was so jittery that it was hard to get any read at all on him. So far, he'd been the least warrior-like of the team, though admittedly, during both battles with the walkers, he'd been quick and efficient. Grace said that he'd been half-crazed when Alpha Team found him, and maybe that's what I was seeing here, the after-effects of fighting solo against those monsters. I remembered my own reactions after I fought Javad. I freaked, I threw up, and I had the shakes. On the other hand, he, like Ollie, had told us that he'd been taken off guard at the crab plant. I studied his face. There was no way to know if the mole was even on my team, let alone whether it was Ollie Brown or Skip Tyler. But of the two choices, I found it hardest to believe it of Skip. Maybe that was his shtick, or maybe he was as innocent as he seemed. I was too exhausted to trust my own judgment. "Our forensics guy figured out how you got taken," I said after a moment. He came to point like a bird dog. "What the hell did happen? Secret door?" "Secret door," I agreed. "Son of a bitch." I nodded. Skip looked at the tabletop for a long time, and when he raised his head, his eyes were wet. "I'm sorry, sir." I waited. "I should have checked. You're lucky you weren't killed." He looked away for a moment while he took a steadying breath. "Sir, after what I saw in there yesterday and today, after what I did..."
"What you did?"
"I shot women and kids, old ladies, people. I killed a lot of people," he said in a whisper. His mouth trembled and he put his face in his hands and he began to weep. I sat back in my chair and watched him. His grief was everywhere. It filled the room. I wondered what Rudy was thinking about all of this. The DMS had cameras that no one could spot, and Rudy was in the adjoining room watching it all. Chapter 76, Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 1:18 p.m. After I dismissed Skip, my phone buzzed. It was Grace.
"Joe," she said urgently. "It's all Dean. Hurry."
I ran out of the room and sprinted across the parking lot and into the interrogation van where I saw Aldin lying on the floor. Dr. Hu and two nurses were working frantically over him, and the little prisoner was shuddering with convulsions. Everyone was wearing surgical masks and latex gloves. I snatched a set off the table and pulled them on.
"We're losing him,"
Hu hissed desperately. "What's happening?" I asked, dropping down beside Grace, who was holding Aldin's feet.
"It's the control disease. It's activated. He's dying."
I shot a look at Church. "I thought you said that you gave him the antidote."
"We did," Church said. "It's not working."
"I think it's a different disease," Hu said as he worked. "This one's much more aggressive. Maybe a different strain. I don't know."
I placed my hands on Aldine's chest to try and keep his body from thrashing, but I was pissed.
"Oh, come on, Doc. Two different control viruses? That's bullshit."
As if to contradict me, Aldin went into full-blown convulsions, every muscle in his body seeming to seize and clutch at once. It was so sudden and so powerful that it nearly threw us off him.
My,
Aldin tried to talk past clenched teeth.
"Clear his mouth," I snapped.
Hu hesitated, looking to Church, who nodded.
"The captain gave you an order, doctor."
With great reluctance, Hu removed the air tube. Aldin coughed and gagged.
"My children,"
he gasped.
Are they safe?
Yes, I said, not knowing if it was true or not. We got to them in time. They're safe. He closed his eyes, and the violence of the tremors seemed to diminish as relief flooded his face.
Thank you. Thank Allah.
I put my hand on his shoulder and gave him a little squeeze. He settled back against the floor, the convulsions fading for the moment. Tell us how to help you. Al-Din shook his head.
I don't know. The pills always worked before.
Who looked at me?
We don't have your pills. We're using what we found at the first two sites.
Al-Din suddenly went into another fit, and when it passed, he looked considerably weaker, more dead than alive. He tried to say something, but his voice was barely a whisper. I leaned close, strained to hear.
Save them.
Your children are safe, I assured him, but he shook his head.
No, save them. Save all of them. There is still time. Save them.
Who? Who do you want us to save? He couldn't form the word. Blood seeped from his nose. He closed his eyes, and a tear of watery blood fell from his left eye. When he opened his eyes, one pupil was massive, a clear sign of a cerebral hemorrhage. He was fighting to hold on with everything he had, and I felt myself admiring him for the ferocity of his struggle, and, truth be told, for the lengths he had been willing to go to protect his children. But this was a fight he couldn't win. He knew it, too. We all did. He forced his mouth to shape the words slowly.
Lester.
Lester? I said. He nodded. Lester who? Al-Din tried to answer, failed, shook his head. He turned and spat blood onto the floor. Al-Din, who is this Lester? Give me a last name. Who is he? What does he do? Tell me something.
Find Lester,
he whispered, and struggled as the next wave of spasms tore through him. Blood was welling through his skin, erupting from his pores. It was like his whole body was disintegrating. With the last fragment of his will, he shaped another word, and I bent close to him to catch it. His voice was faint, a fading whisper.
Bell. Bell Maker.
And then he was gone. He sagged down and lay utterly still. Grace let out the breath she was holding and sat back, pushing a damp strand of hair out of her eyes. She looked at Al-Din, and then at me.
Lester Bellmaker, she said. Have you ever heard of him?
I reached out and closed Aldine's eyes. No, I said tiredly. It doesn't mean a thing to me.
Doesn't ring a bell, huh?
Who said in an offhand tone, and I wheeled on him. You're a half step away from life on a ventilator, asshole. Who recoiled. Geez, sorry, I was just trying to make a joke. It's not like he was one of the good guys.
Shut up,
Church said, ever so softly. Who flinched as if Church had slapped him, and he got up and walked to the far end of the van and threw himself into a chair. I stood as well and looked down at Al-Din. Did I lie to him, Church? Or did we really rescue his kids? Church got to his feet and peeled off his mask and gloves.
We were too late by about 3 days. The whole village was already gone. Someone let some walkers loose. All of the bodies were laid out for us to find. There was another tape. El Mujahid. It's on my laptop.
I punched a nearby cabinet and left a dent in it.
I can't tell you how much I want to find this guy. You can keep my paycheck, Church. Just promise me that when we find El Mujahid, I get to be locked in a room with him, him and me.
You'll have to get in line, snarled Grace. First things first, advised Church. We need to identify this Lester Bellmaker. If he's a link to El Mujahid, then we need to jump on it.
I'll run it through Mind Reader, offered Grace. If his name is on anyone's database, we'll find him,
she hurried out.
Church and I stood there still looking down at Aldin.
Did you get anything else out of him? I asked.
Bits and pieces. It looks like the crab plant was the hub of this whole operation. People were abducted, infected, and studied. Aldin said that there was no plan that he knew of to release them at the present time. Once a subject was completely transitioned, his word, they were simply stored. He said that his team was studying the varying rates of infection based on age, race, body weight, ethnic background, and so on. The children in Delaware were part of a new phase of the experiment, but he had few details. Sergeant Dietrich tells me that the blast did not destroy all of those computers you found, which means that we should be able to harvest some or all of 14 months of their findings. Dr. Who, and here he cut a brief hard look at his pet mad scientist, thinks that it'll shortcut the search for a cure.
Cure? I thought prion diseases couldn't be cured.
Doctor,
Church beckoned to him,
if you please.
Who approached me the way a limping caribou approaches a cheetah?
Okay, true, you can't cure a prion disease. The key is to stop the parasite that triggers the aggression and accelerates the rate of infection. We might be able to get a handle on that based on some things Aldin told us. Stop the parasite and you slow the rate of infection from minutes to months. If we can get ahead of the timetable, we might be able to immunize against the parasite. It won't save anyone who gets infected with the prion disease, of course, but it will give us time to isolate the carriers, and they probably won't become aggressive and try to bite people. They'll just be sick people.
You're saying you could inoculate everyone? There are over 300 million Americans, plus travelers, tourists, illegal aliens. How could you produce and distribute enough antidote?
Well, he said awkwardly, we couldn't. We'd have to bring in major pharmaceutical companies to help us. Maybe a lot of them, and it'll be expensive. We're talking billions of dollars in research and more than that in practical distribution. To inoculate everyone who lives in or might ever visit the U.S., that'll cost trillions.
Which might be the point of all of this, Church said. A crisis of this magnitude could easily shift the economic focus of the United States away from war and into preventive medicine. We couldn't continue to fund our big-ticket war efforts overseas if we had to throw those kinds of resources into combating diseases. The jihadists know that they can't put a big enough army into the field to oppose the U.S., so it seems that they've picked a different kind of battlefield, one where our greater numbers work against us.
I whistled. It was a horrible plan, but a damn smart one.
And it's not like we can choose whether to do it or not, Who said. We have to because we know they still have the disease.
I nodded. And just because we know about it doesn't mean they won't try to release the virus anyway.
I think we should start considering which pharmaceutical companies to approach, Who said. I mean, after you've talked to the president.
Mr. Church, I said, I sure as hell hope you have a few friends in this industry. He almost smiled.
One or two.
Chapter 77. Crisfield, Maryland, Wednesday, July 1st, 5:37 p.m. After I left the interrogation van, I went over to the communications center and asked for a secure line to Top Sims, who had taken Echo Team back to the warehouse. He gave me a quick rundown, and we talked staffing strategies for a few minutes. Then I spent a few hours with Jerry Spencer and gave him my step-by-step account of Echo Team's actions. With that out of the way, I commandeered a DMS Crown Vic, chased the driver off with a grumpy mumble, and climbed in the back to try and grab a few hours of sleep. I felt more than spent. I felt like I'd been opened up, reamed out, and then beaten with hammers. I was no good to any part of this investigation the way I felt. As I waited for sleep to take me, I tried to organize the things that had happened and weigh them against what we learned. Now that the combat part of the day was over, the cop part of my mind was in charge. I mentally laid out the evidence and let it speak to me the way a crime scene speaks to Jerry. I drifted off to sleep, but the cop stood his watch. I didn't wake until after midnight.
though the sounds outside were the same. Shouts, portable generators, the whoop-whoop of helicopters, the buzz of indecipherable conversation. I lay there and realized that I knew what was going on. With the plant? With the walkers? Maybe all of it. Sometimes it happens that way. You go to sleep with puzzle pieces scattered everywhere, and somehow, in the depths of sleep, the puzzle pieces fall into place. When you wake up, you can sometimes see with startling clarity. I opened my eyes and stared at the shadow-darkened ceiling of the car. "Oh, man," I said aloud. 5 seconds later, I was hurrying to find Jerry Spencer.
Chapter 78. Sebastian Galt, The Hotel Ishtar, Baghdad, Thursday, July 2nd.
Line?
Clear as a bell, my sweet.
Sebastian.
The way Amirov said it made Galt feel warm everywhere.
I've missed you so.
Me too.
His voice was husky, and it nearly cracked. He covered the mouthpiece and cleared his throat.
I want you, he murmured.
I need you,
she replied, and Galt could feel the sweat popping out on his forehead. Galt opened his eyes and looked around the hotel room. It seemed so drab, so overtly empty. Toys had gone shopping in the bazaar with a female rock star who was in town to entertain the troops. Galt wished he were back in Afghanistan. With her. He shook his head and made himself change the subject.
A lot's happened, he said, his voice suddenly brisk and businesslike. He told her about the raid on the crab plant.
You let them have the computers?
Her voice sounded shocked, almost frightened.
I let them have some of the computers. All of it was old data, nothing past Generation 3, though they won't be able to tell that from the time coding. They'll think this is all recent research data.
You're sure?
Quite sure. They'll have more than they need to understand the earlier generations of the pathogen. Scientists will be queuing up to get federal grant money to study it.
What are you saying? That we have done? That we should call off the operation?
Good Lord, no. Your loving husband and his merry little prank is going to be the icing on this cake. Without him, the Yanks might lapse into one of those periods of red tape where everything gets talked about in committees, but nothing actually gets done. No, dear heart. We need them frightened. Terrified. So terrified, in fact, that they are too scared not to act. Once El Mujahid is pulled off his stunt, then they will be in full gear. No doubt about it.
Stunt?
Amira said, and Galt could hear the change in her voice, which had suddenly dropped to 1 degree above freezing.
I would hardly call a heroic sacrifice a stunt or a prank.
I'm sorry, he said with a purr. I don't mean to disparage his sacrifice if I offended you.
He listened very closely to her as she replied, and he noted the hesitation, small though it was, before she spoke.
Oh, of course not.
Her voice sounded light.
But I think we should maintain some respect. After all, he is a freedom fighter. He believes in his cause, even if we do not.
And there it was again, the slightest fragment of hesitation before she said, we. It came close to breaking his heart.
How is the shutdown process going?
He asked, changing tack again.
It's going well.
There it was again. Damn it!
We should be completely shut down by the end of the week.
And the staff?
I'll take care of them.
It had always been their intention to gather all non-essential personnel together once El Mujahid's heroic sacrifice was underway and to terminate them. The largest staff room was rigged to lock down and flood with gas. Only certain key people would be spared, and those few would form the nucleus of a new team that would start an entirely new line of research. All records of the Saif al-Din pathogen and the years of lab work that had gone into its creation would be dumped to coded disks and then stored in one of Galt's most secure locations. Everything else would be deleted or destroyed, all computer memory wiped. That was Amira's current task, and she'd promised to do it, but there was something in her voice that troubled Galt.
I'm glad you're taking care of things, my love. Do you want me to come and help you clean up the last details?
No, she said quickly. I have everything under control. You have more important things to do.
Yes, I suppose I have.
He paused and said softly,
I love you, Amira.
There was a final pause, and then she murmured,
I love you too.
After the line went dead, Galt stood for a long while looking out the window at the plaza below. The erotic elation he'd felt when he had first heard her voice was completely gone. No, that was wrong. There was just enough of it left to make his heart hurt.
Amira,
he whispered to the night. Grief was like a heavy stone around his neck. Galt was too practiced a deceiver to be deceived. Amira, though clever, was far less skilled at guile. What was it the Americans were so fond of saying? Never bullshit a bullshitter. Her pauses had been too long, and in all the wrong places. Some of the inflections were brittle. He wondered if she was aware of it, and doubted it. She was sure of her sexual control over him. Galt was certain of that, just as he was certain she was lying to him, about her lab and her staff. That could be a real problem, and he knew that he would need to take a look, that he would need to go back to Afghanistan, even though it was a poor security risk, with so many things in motion. And she was certainly lying about El Mujahid. Her comment about his sacrifice was telling, and the things it implied broke his heart. He went and built himself a gin and tonic, but as he tumbled ice into the glass, he saw that his hands were shaking.
God damn her!
He roared and abruptly hurled the glass across the room with such savage force that it shattered into thousands of silvery fragments that fell glistening to the carpet. He sagged back against the wet bar.
Damn you,
he said again, and now his eyes burned with tears. What should he infer from this and from the other hints he'd picked up over the last few weeks? Did Amira really have feelings for her brute of a husband? Was that even possible? After all of the sex, after all of the constant betrayal and the plotting behind the fighter's back, could she have fallen back in love with El Mujahid? Galt reached for another glass and mixed another drink, swallowed half of it down a dry throat, and poured more gin into it without adding any extra tonic. Then, something occurred to him that made his heart go still in his chest. He could hear his pulse throbbing in his ears as the new thought blossomed from a seed of suspicion into a fully realized belief. The gin in his stomach turned to sickness as he realized that all of the pieces of this puzzle did actually fit together, but that the picture they made was one that he had never expected or foreseen. What if Amira had never stopped loving El Mujahid? What if this whole thing, from the very beginning before their clandestine meeting in Tikrit, what if everything she had done for him and with him and to him had been part of an older scheme? One that was not of his design. What if this had been something Amira and El Mujahid had cooked up themselves, something they'd twisted so subtly that he thought he had recruited them? What if they'd suckered him into financing their scheme instead of the other way around? Toys had once suggested this as a possibility, but Galt had dismissed it with a laugh. But now, what if it was all true?
Good Christ,
he said aloud, and now his hands were shaking so badly that gin sloshed out of his glass onto his shirt front. What if Amira and El Mujahid were not helping him scam the U.S. government out of billions in research and production money? What if money was not even the point? Was that possible? He wondered. But the answer was so obvious. Toys had been right all along. The truth now burned in front of his mind's eye like a flare. There was only one thing more powerful than money, especially in this part of the world. What if
This was jihad.
Dolph staggered backward and his back crashed against the wet bar. His legs turned to rubber and he sat down hard on the floor, the rest of his drink splashing onto his thighs. He didn't feel the wetness or the cold. All he could feel was a rising sense of terror as the realization that he had given the world's deadliest weapon to a wickedly clever assassin and ensured that nothing could stop the release of the Saif al-Din pathogen. El-Mujahid was not carrying the weaker strain of the disease with him, Galt was certain of that now. The fighter was taking with him Amira's newest strain, Generation 7, the unstoppable one, the one that infected too quickly for any kind of response. The fighter would release it and the plague would sweep the Western Hemisphere. Did Amira think that its spread could be held back by oceans? Or in her religious madness did she no longer care? He crawled across the floor to the table and grabbed his cell phone, hit speed dial, and waited through four interminable rings before Toys answered with a musical, "Hello?"
"Get back here,"
Galt said in a hoarse whisper. "What's wrong?" Toys said sharply, his voice low and urgent.
"It's..."
Galt began, then a sob broke in his chest.
"My God, Toys. I think I've killed us all."
The phone fell from his hands as the black reality of apocalypse bloomed like a mushroom cloud.
Chapter 79. Crisfield, Maryland, Thursday, July 2nd, 3:13 p.m. I spent half the day with Jerry. Once I'd explained my theories, we set about comparing them with what he'd deduced from his forensic walkthroughs. We were both on the same page. I told Jerry to round up all the forensics experts that had arrived while I'd been sleeping, and I went off to find Church. Outside, I ran into Rudy. He accompanied me to the computer van where Church and Grace were using Mind Reader to search for Lester Bellmaker. "Jerry Spencer's ready to give a preliminary forensics report," I said. "I think we should set that up sooner than later."
"You have something?"
Grace asked, searching my face. "Maybe, but I want you both to hear the forensics first, and then we can play what if." Church made a call to set up the meeting. Grace told us that Mind Reader had come up with two Lester Bellmakers in North America and six more in the UK, but so far none of them appeared to have even the slightest connection to terrorists, diseases, or Baltimore. The closest hit had been a Richard Lester Bellmaker, who served a tour in the Air Force from 1984 to 1987 and was discharged honorably. That was it. The guy managed a Chuck E. Cheese outside of Akron, Ohio, and no matter how deep Grace searched into his background, the guy didn't ring a single damn bell.
"We're getting nowhere," she said.
"And slowly," Church agreed.
"Could Aldine have been lying to us?" Grace asked, cutting a look at Rudy. "You watched the interrogation videos, and you read the telemetry feeds. What's your assessment?"
Rudy shrugged. "From what I could see, that man was desperate to tell the truth. That much was in his voice. He was trying to make a dying declaration, and he wanted to go out with as clear a conscience as possible."
"So he was telling the truth?" Grace asked.
Rudy pursed his lips.
"It's probably fair to say that he was telling the truth as he knew it. But we can't discount the possibility that he may have been regurgitating disinformation fed to him by the guards."
"Too right," Grace agreed. "Which means we could be wasting time and resources on a wild goose chase."
"So what do we do now?" Rudy asked.
"Keep looking," Church said.
Chapter 80. Sebastian Galt, The Hotel Ishtar, Baghdad, July 2nd.
The door to Galt's hotel room banged open and Toys came rushing in with a pistol in his hand. All affect was gone, and in its place was a reptilian coldness as he swept the gun across the room. Seeing Galt on the floor, Toys kicked the door shut behind him and rushed to his employer's side.
"Are you hurt?"
he asked quickly, searching for signs of blood or damage.
"No,"
Galt gasped.
"No, it's..."
He disintegrated into tears. Toys studied him with narrowed eyes. He lowered the hammer on his gun and slid it into the shoulder holster he wore under his jacket. Then he caught Galt under the armpits and, with surprising strength, hauled him to his feet and walked him to a chair. Galt sat there, face in hands, sobbing. Toys locked the door and verified that the electronic bug detectors were still operating. Then he dragged an ottoman over and sat down in front of Galt.
"Sebastian,"
Toys said softly,
"tell me what happened."
Galt slowly raised a tear-streaked face to him. His eyes had a look of hopeless panic.
"Whatever it is, we can deal with it,"
Toys assured him. Uncertainly, and with stuttering words, Galt told him about the call to Amira and of the dreadful realization that had bloomed in his mind. Toy's face underwent a process of change from deep concern to disbelief, and then to fury.
"That fucking bitch!"
"Amira!"
Galt's voice disintegrated into tears again. Without word or warning, Toys slapped Galt across the face with vicious speed and force. Galt was flung half out of the chair. Galt stared at him, his tears stilled by the impossibility of what had just happened. Toys leaned close and in a deadly quiet voice said,
"Stop your blubbering, Sebastian. Stop it right fucking now."
Galt was too stunned to speak.
"Try, for once, to think with your brain instead of your cock. If you had, you'd have seen this coming. I bloody well saw it coming, and I've been warning you about that bitch and her husband for years. Christ, Sebastian, I ought to kick the shit out of you!"
Galt climbed back into the chair, eyes still unblinking. Toy sat back and waited until the immediacy of his rage passed.
"How sure are you about this? Is this a guess, or do you know?"
I don't know for sure,"
Galt managed.
"But it all just came to me in a flash."
"Came to you in a flash?"
Toys sneered.
"Mother Mary save me.
If they..."
"Shut up," Toys said as he fished out his phone. He dialed a number. A voice answered on the third ring.
"Line?"
Toys asked.
"Clear," said the American. "I'm calling on behalf of our patron. There's a problem. Listen to me very closely and take all appropriate action. The princess and the boxer have gone off the reservation."
"What?
Why?"
Toy's mouth made an ugly shape as he said,
"They think they're still in church."
That wasn't an agreed code word, but Toy's was sure the American would grasp the meaning, and he did.
"I never trusted those two from the beginning. Jesus H. Christ! Yes, well, that's a comfort to all of us, isn't it?"
Toys disconnected and stared at Galt.
"Listen to me, Sebastian. If L. Musclehead is going to launch the latest generation of the plague in America, then we have to assume that Amira has taken some precautions."
Galt's eyes came back into focus.
"Precautions?"
"She's a wacko, I agree. But I can't believe that she'd want to destroy the entire world. A lot of them are true believers, don't forget."
Galt sat up straight.
"What are you saying?"
"I'm saying that she probably has a bloody cure for this thing. Or a treatment. Something that will keep it from wiping out her own people. El Mujahid might already have been inoculated, but that's beside the point. What we have to do is get our ruddy asses to the bunker, beat some information out of your girlfriend, and then make sure Gen 2000 starts cranking out the cure just in case our American friend doesn't stop the fighter in time."
"The bunker. Yes."
Galt nodded, and his jaw lost some of its softness. His eyes grew several degrees colder.
"Yes. Amira will have thought it through."
Toys cut him off.
"Understand me, Sebastian," he said in an icy voice. "I work for you, and I love you like a brother. But you've endangered me by letting this thing get out of hand. I warned you about Amira 100 times, and now she stabbed you in the back. If she has a cure, then we are going to bloody well get it."
His green eyes glittered.
"And then we are going to put a bullet right through that brilliant little brain of hers."
Galt closed his eyes for a moment, as if to block out that image. But when he opened them, Toys saw that some kind of change had occurred. The eyes that looked out at him from Galt's puffy and tear-streaked face were vicious, almost feral in their hateful intensity.
"Yes,"
he snarled. Chapter 81. Crisfield, Maryland, Thursday, July 2nd, 6 p.m. The forensics tent was set up in one corner of the parking lot. As Dietrich had promised, it was an actual circus tent. The silk sides and scalloped dome were painted with brightly colored animals, elephants, zebras, giraffes, and monkeys, and around the base was a life-sized line of capering clowns. Inside, Jerry Spencer was the ringmaster. Teams of experts had spent the whole day collecting evidence and transporting it out of the building in protective bags. The tent had several hermetically sealed plastic clean rooms that were marked with the logo of the Centers for Disease Control. Men and women wearing white hazmat suits worked in one of these, and they had a production line going with one autopsy after another. A refrigeration truck was backed up to that end of the tent, and the bodies of autopsied walkers were double-sealed in body bags and stacked like cordwood inside. There were a dozen experts at the meeting, along with Jerry, Grace, Dietrich, Rudy, and Hu. Somehow, Church had managed to change into a clean suit. I was still in the soiled fatigue pants and T-shirt I'd worn under the hammer suit. I must have smelled pretty ripe.
"Let's start with the bodies," Jerry said as soon as everyone was seated. He nodded to a tall black woman with golden skin and pale brown eyes.
Dr. Clarita McWilliams was a professor of forensic pathology at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia.
"We have a total body count of 274. That breaks down as follows: 11 terrorist soldiers, 5 scientists and technicians, 2 unspecified support staff, 5 DMS personnel, and 251 of the, walkers."
She briefly looked around the room through her half-moon glasses, then cleared her throat and plowed ahead.
"There were 91 adult male walkers, 122 adult female walkers, 21 male children under the apparent age of 18, and 17 female children of the same approximate age. The ethnic breakdown of the walkers stands at 124 Caucasians, 73 black, 28 Asian, and 26 Hispanic. If you want a more precise racial breakdown, it'll take some time."
"So what does that tell us?" I asked.
"It's close enough to a general population cross-section," McWilliams said. "Maybe a little heavy on the male-to-female mix. If there's a pattern, it isn't yet apparent."
"What do we know about where these people were from?" I asked. Dietrich held up his hand.
"I've been working on that using recovered wallets, cell phones, and so on. Most of these people seem to be concentrated in Maryland, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, none from anywhere else."
"Just like the kids in Delaware," I said. "Random, but all East Coast."
"Any IDs with the name Lester Bellmaker?"
Grace asked.
"Or any variation on Bellmaker? Maybe Bellmacher or something like that?"
Dietrich scanned a sheet of paper on a clipboard.
"Nah. Closest we have there is Jennifer Bellamy, no Lesters."
"It's a dead end," Church said quietly. "We have to consider that the name is an alias."
"Aldine seemed to think it was important to give it to us," I said.
"He used his last breath."
"Time will tell," Church said. "Anything else, Dr. McWilliams?"
She shook her head.
"Medically speaking, we haven't yet found anything that goes outside of what Dr. Hu has already shared regarding these walkers. One item of interest is that less than half of the victims I've seen displayed any visible bite marks. Most have injection marks, and presumably that's how the pathogen was introduced."
Grace asked,
"Of the ones with the bite marks, have you determined if any of them were bitten post-mortem?"
"No. There's no evidence that these walkers preyed on each other. That suggests that they are attracted only to living flesh."
She looked ill as she said it.
"Like in the movies," Hu said, but she ignored him.
I turned to Jerry.
"What's next?"
"Frank?"
he asked, turning to Frank Sessa, a sturdy man of about 60 with a shaved head, wire-framed glasses, and the calloused knuckles of a long-time karate practitioner. Frank and I went way back, both in martial arts circles and through chemical analysis work he did for law enforcement. Sessa laced his fingers and leaned forward on his forearms.
"Your terrorists have some odd choices when it comes to explosives. They used explosive organic peroxide. It's a colorless liquid with a pretty strong smell. It's generally stored as a 25% solution in dimethyl phthalate to prevent detonation. So, whoever rigged the booby traps knew something about temperature control as applied to explosives. This is difficult stuff to work with and way above the level of what I'd expect from a Unabomber wannabe."
He gave us a technical rundown on how this stuff is made, handled, and used. It was pretty damn disturbing news.
Now, I understand that these walker things are also dormant at low temperatures, Sessa said. And on the surface, there might be a tendency to say, well, the place is already cold, so that's why they chose an explosive that is safest at low temps, but I'd hesitate going there. There are plenty of explosives that are not nearly as temperature sensitive as this stuff. I don't know who your bad guys are, but to me it kind of looks like someone was showing off. It's too much bomb for the purpose to which it was put, and they used the wrong amounts in at least two places.
What do you mean? Dietrich asked. I said nothing. I thought I already knew the answer. So did Jerry.
Well, the amount they had at the door where they were storing the infected people, that was too big or too small, depending on how you look at it. If the intent was to blow open the door or kill whoever tried to open it, then it was too much. On the other hand, if it was intended to destroy the contents of the room, it was way too small. If they'd been using dynamite, I'd have dismissed it as some fool who doesn't understand how explosives work, but then we have the computer room. There was a good amount of the explosive, but it was all at one end of the room. If their intent had been to destroy all of the computers, they could have used less of the material but put a portion inside each of the units. Less blast, but much more effect in terms of security. He shook his head. Now, this is a combination of high-tech knowledge, lots of money, and strange choices.
Jerry gave me a knowing smile, but I kept my face straight.
For the next 2 hours, we heard from one expert after another. Ballistics told us what we expected. The terrorists were using standard AK-47s and a variety of bought-on-the-street handguns. The AKs were converted to take M16 magazines and standard NATO 7.62mm rounds. That's nothing new. Gun collectors have been doing it for years. The fingerprint guys lifted plenty of sets, and so far three of the terrorists had popped up on the computers, each with known ties to Al-Qaeda or El-Mujahid. Of the scientists, none of them were in the computers, but that wasn't particularly surprising. Church's chief computer wizard, Utada, spoke next.
As Mr. Sessa pointed out, we aren't seeing a total loss with the computers. In fact, we got pretty lucky because two mainframes are completely intact and we're salvaging stuff from three more.
What have we found so far? Grace asked.
Who answered that?
Tons. If the data is supported by the lab work my guys are doing right now, then we might have a name for some or all of the component parasites. That's going to save us a lot of time in putting together a protocol.
I thanked the forensics experts and let them get back to work, though Jerry stayed behind.
Church said, "We haven't actually heard from you yet, Detective Spencer. What are your thoughts on this?"
Jerry smiled and gave me a sly look.
"Captain Hotshot here already knows what I'm thinking, but let me give it to those of you who aren't cops."
It was a nice dig at the feds in the room. I did my best not to smirk.
"Point one," he said, ticking the items off on his fingers. "This place is built to be a rat maze. The only viable entry point was the door Joe's team used. From an approach point of view, nothing else was moderately safe. I believe that these suckers planned it that way. Point two. Once Joe and his boys were inside, they were offered a single route to follow. Anyone who's in this business would know that they'd leave a man behind to guard the door. There was only one possible position a shooter would take to defend that position, and right behind him, there was a hidden door on well-oiled hinges. Absolutely silent when it opened, allowing an ambush man to sneak up and taser young what's-his-name.
Skip Tyler, I supplied.
Yeah, Tyler. They take him out with a liquid taser, cart him off, and dump him in a room, but they leave his weapons where he can easily find them. Why not just cut his throat or feed him directly to the walkers? There's only one way that makes sense. He didn't elaborate on that point quite yet. Point three. They take out the second guy. He snapped his fingers at me. Ollie Brown. Right. They taser Brown and drag him down to their lab. Now, the bad guys know full well that they've been infiltrated, so why the drama? Why capture Joe's guys instead of killing them? There were only three armed DMS agents left, and between the armed guards in the building and a couple hundred walkers, they could easily have simply wiped the team out, or taken them hostage to use as bargaining chips. They didn't try. They didn't even try to use Brown as a hostage when Joe broke in. They didn't try to flee. No.
It doesn't add up. This whole thing should have been a massacre or a standoff, and it was neither.
Came pretty bloody close, muttered Grace.
Don't get me wrong, Major, Jerry said. I'm not saying they were interested in the well-being of your teams. It probably would have worked out equally well for these guys if you'd all died in there.
Charming,
Grace said. My point is that this was not a matter of them fighting back. Nothing that I've seen supports that. Tell me I'm wrong, Joe.
You know you're right, Jerry, I told him. The others around the table were staring at us, and there was a mixture of expressions. Church's face, as usual, told me nothing, but Grace was nodding, putting the pieces together herself. Rudy had one eyebrow raised, the way he did when he was looking in at his own thoughts. Dietrich looked a little puzzled and kept looking to Church, as if for instructions. Who looked skeptical.
Why would they do that? Who asked.
Because they wanted us to find what we found, I said. Who shook his head.
No, no way, that doesn't make sense.
Yes, it does, murmured Church. We all looked at him, but he nodded to me.
You have the floor.
All of this is a setup, I said. Jerry's absolutely right. They could have taken us out, and should have. We had a small team and no intelligence at all about the inside of the building. Once we were inside, they shut down the refrigeration units and turned up the heat to activate all of the walkers that had been lying dormant before we got there. So, between the booby trap in the big warehouse room, the walkers released into the halls, and the appearance of the guards who suddenly decided to open up with their AKs, we were herded into the lab. They set explosives in the computer room, but not enough to destroy all of their research, and none of the armed guards in the hall tried to use a key card to enter the lab. Jerry checked. Their key cards had the right code, but they didn't use them. We were played.
To what end? Rudy asked. I mean, I can see the shape of it when you lay it out like that, but what's the point? You've managed to kill all of the walkers, all of their scientists and personnel are dead. We have the computers, and we have whatever else can be salvaged from the lab. The way you're describing it, the terrorists have handed us the solution to the threat.
When I didn't answer, he added,
Why would they do something like that?
Chapter 82 El Mujahid, Pier 12, Brooklyn, New York. The freighter Albert Schweitzer docked at Pier 12 in the shadow of the Queen Elizabeth II and was met by a parking lot filled with ambulances, paratransit vehicles, limousines, and cabs. The ambulatory wounded were escorted down the boarding ramp by nurses and orderlies, the more serious cases wheeled in chairs or on gurneys. Sonny Bertucci walked down under his own steam, though he used a cane and looked frail. He was met by two agents from Global Security. They led him to a white van with the name of a private ambulance company stenciled on the doors. The agents got into the back with Bertucci, and the driver shut the door, climbed into the cab, and drove out of the parking lot, and within half an hour, they were on the New Jersey Turnpike heading south. At the Thomas Edison rest stop, the van pulled around behind a row of parked semis and stopped next to a black Ford Explorer with Pennsylvania plates. Both drivers got out and shook hands, and together they walked around to the back of the white van. The van driver knocked three times, waited, and knocked once more before opening the door. "Your ride is..." That was as far as he got. The driver of the Explorer pressed a silenced .22 against the back of his head and fired two quick shots. The van driver collapsed just as the doors opened. Sonny Bertucci reached out and caught him, and together he and the Explorer's driver hauled the corpse into the van, laying it next to the two bodies of the Global Security agents. Both of them had their throats cut, and the big man held the hook of his cane in his left hand. The hook ended in a 6-inch wickedly sharp stiletto that had fit into the shaft of the cane, the seam hidden by a decorative metal band. Bertucci tossed the weapon into the back, and together he and the driver of the Explorer closed and locked the van doors. When they were done, they embraced warmly, slapping each other on the back.
"It is so good to see you," beamed the driver.
El Mujahid grinned, despite the pain of his healing wounds.
"Ahmed, it is very good to see a friend in this place."
He paused and jerked his chin toward the van.
"Galt knows?" "So it seems,"
said Ahmed. I received a call about 15 minutes ago saying that you were to be terminated. I assume one of them, the driver said, jerking his head toward the closed van, got a similar call.
Yes, it came in while we were driving. I couldn't hear what was said, but I could tell from his eyes that he'd gotten a kill order. Thank you for taking care of things.
My pleasure. Come, let us go. We cannot risk being here if Galt has other agents coming.
Once they were both seated inside the Explorer and pulling back into the flow of traffic, Ahmed asked,
What is the news from home? How is my sister?
El Mujahid smiled.
Amira sends her love.
I miss her.
The fighter patted the man on the shoulder.
Soon we will all be together, in this world or in paradise.
Praise Allah,
said Ahmed as he accelerated to 70 and headed south.
Chapter 83 Sebastian Galt over Afghani airspace. Thursday, July 2nd.
It's a real honor to have Mr. Galt make this visit,
said Nanya Dreen, the Red Cross liaison for Afghanistan.
And a bit of a surprise. If we'd had more notice, we would have prepared a better reception.
Toys forced a smile.
Not necessary, Doctor. This is just a visit, not an inspection.
The helicopter's roar made conversation difficult, for which he was grateful. The preening doctor had to shout to be heard. Galt sat across from him, pretending to be asleep, but Toys knew better. The doctor nodded.
I understand, and I suppose advertising it in advance is bad for security.
Indeed.
Good thinking, sir, said the doctor.
Too bloody right it's good thinking, Toys mused darkly. Last thing they needed was Amira knowing that they were on the way. The only people expecting their arrival in Afghanistan was a crack team of mercenaries from Global Security, led by one of Toy's favorite people, the ruthless South African Captain Zeller. Toy's had called to make arrangements explaining what they intended. Zeller didn't bat an eye when Toy's told him that this was going to be a wet operation. Wet works were their specialty, and they loved the bonuses he'd promised for their pay packets. The chopper flew on toward the Red Cross Field Hospital. Galt had pulled himself together on the drive to the heliport, but Toys was cautious. Nothing was ever certain in matters of the heart. He was glad that he didn't have one. Chapter 84 Crisfield, Maryland, Thursday, July 2nd, 8:30 p.m. Here's the problem, I said. In one way or another, over the last couple of days, I've said that I found it hard to buy the scenario that we've been fed— that this is a group of terrorists who have the smarts, the funding, and the technology to create several new diseases, to pioneer new fields of science in order to manipulate and weaponize those diseases, to locate and hold hostage the families of key scientists, and to manage those scientists through the use of not one, but two control diseases, and all of it off the radar of all the world's top intelligence networks.
When you put it that way, Dietrich said, shifting uncomfortably.
From the beginning, I was bothered by the control disease because it's way too sophisticated. Who here thinks that a bunch of terrorists really thought that up? Show of hands.
When no one raised a hand, Dietrich said, But we know that this is the case.
Instead of answering, I said, The next thing to consider is the crab plant itself. As Jerry pointed out, it was a trap from the beginning, no doubt about it. The staff inside, to all intents and purposes, were suicide fighters. Either they knew they weren't getting out of there alive, or they were duped into thinking that they were playing a stronger hand than they were.
I doubt the scientists were in on it, Grace said.
At least one was, I said, and reminded them about the one with the detonator. He said that it was already too late. I'm not sure what he meant by that, though it's pretty clear that we'd know if the Saif al-Din pathogen had been released into the public.
We're still looking for additional cells, Church said. This is clearly not over, and directly after this meeting I'll make a conference call to the CDC and the White House.
Good. Now getting back to my theory. I'm no science geek, but from what Rudy and Hu have said, everything we've seen is absolutely cutting edge. Stuff that would be science fiction if we hadn't actually experienced it firsthand.
What's your point? Asked Dietrich. We know these assholes are smart.
I shook my head. Yeah, well, smart is a relative term. You can have real geniuses act like idiots sometimes. I tried hard not to look at Hu when I said this, but out of the corner of my eye I saw him shift in his seat.
You see, these guys have done stuff that's needlessly sophisticated. The control diseases, the fancy explosives. Whoever's behind this seems to think that the expensive toys work better, but all they really do is send up red flags. He's drawing attention to his own attempts at being slick. "Doc," I said to Hu, "correct me if I'm wrong, but the compound from the treatment recovered from the warehouse, once removed from the aspirin coating, was able to dissolve in ordinary saline, correct?"
"Yes," he agreed. "It's a very small amount of material, a few chemicals that are all soluble in water or saline, barely clouded the fluid."
"How easily could it be detected?"
"In food, you mean? Probably not at all. They're mostly vegetable-based, organic stuff. None of the compounds would significantly affect the taste or smell of most foods."
"So it could have been dissolved into something strong-tasting, say, orange juice, without anyone being the wiser?"
"I suppose so."
"Then why wasn't it?"
The others stared, and I could see them catch on one by one.
"Son of a bitch," growled Dietrich.
Grace said,
"You're right. The process of hiding it in the aspirin is too clever a step. Impressive, but unnecessary."
She was with me on this now, step by step. "That's one point," I said. "Now the second is their intent. We can presume that they did know they were under surveillance the whole time, which means they could have released the walkers, taken suicide pills, blown the place up. Why wait until we infiltrate?"
Rudy snapped his fingers.
"They wanted you to find a functional lab and have a heroic fight. They wanted you to believe that you fought for and obtained the evidence, damaged and partial though it is."
"Right," I said. "Our bad guy wanted to stage a big, scary event that would scare the hell out of us."
"Which it effing well did," Grace said bitterly.
"After Aldeen died, it seemed pretty clear that the terrorists were trying to make us afraid of the possibility of an epidemic, that it might be the new threat, a new kind of warfare that would force the U.S. to divert funding away from tanks and missiles and into preventive medicine. That's probably going to happen, at least in part, because we know that this disease actually exists and that terrorists have it. But before we decide that we know the shape of things, let me ask this. If we do start scrambling for new treatments and cures, who stands to benefit?"
"Dios mío. A lot of people will get rich," Rudy said. "Pharmaceutical companies, drug stores, health organizations, hospitals, pretty much the entire medical profession."
I sat back and stared at him, and then at each person at the table.
"So, why are we so damn sure that terrorists are the only ones behind this thing?"
Chapter 85. Amira, the Bunker, Thursday, July 2nd.
"Sebastian Gold has been spotted by our man in the Red Cross outpost."
Amira looked up from her computer screen at the young Yemen woman who stood in front of her desk.
"When will he get here? Day after tomorrow at the latest?"
Amira chewed her lip thoughtfully.
"Do you want Abdul to—"
Anna left it unsaid. But Amira shook her head.
"No, let him come. It should be an enlightening experience for him."
She smiled at Anna, who flinched before returning the smile. Anna turned and left the room, silently reciting a prayer. For just a moment, Amira's face had looked like that of a desert demon, a jinn. Anna was glad to be away from that evil and totally mirthless grin. Chapter 86. Crisfield, Maryland, Thursday, July 2nd, 8:44 p.m.
"You lost me," Dietrich admitted. "I thought you were saying this was all about shifting the U.S. budget away from war and into research, so... what, are we talking about an axis of evil formed by Walgreens and CVS?"
"Think bigger," Rudy said.
"Doctors, hospitals, drug companies?"
"Bingo," I said. "That's who would stand to make more money if word of this thing got out."
"Then this whole thing is some kind of goddamned advertising campaign?" Dietrich asked.
"In a way," I said. "Show the big scary bug to us, prove to us that terrorists are capable of releasing it. Then let us stop the first wave so that we feel like we've caught a break, but at the same time make us so afraid that the bug might still be out there, still in the hands of terrorists, that we have to scramble to get treatments.